This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Emily Rapp was kind of famous in her Wyoming town when she was a child. At age 6, in 1980, she was chosen as a March of Dimes poster child. The problem that put her on the poster was a rare bone and tissue disorder that made her left leg misshapen and shorter than the right. At age 4, her left foot was amputated. Subsequent surgeries shortened her leg, which was eventually replaced with a prosthetic. Rapp went on to become a Fulbright Scholar and the Philip Roth Writer-in-Residence at Bucknell University. She's now a professor at Antioch University. She's written a new memoir called Poster Child. Let's start with a reading about her memories of the hospital when she had her foot amputated.
On May 26, 1978, a few months before my 4th birthday, I had the repeat osteotomy, a surgical incision into the bone to control a deformity, and my left foot was amputated to ensure a chance for a better fitting and more aesthetic prosthesis in the future. The nurses sang a song from the musical Annie as the anesthesiologist fitted the clear plastic mask over my face in the operating room, and I began to count backward slowly from 10. I regained consciousness in the recovery room with my head over a plastic bowl, vomiting. Recovery is a misnomer for this room, as little recovery happens here. What happens instead is discovery. What's been taken? What's been fixed? What's in a cast? Where does it hurt? I looked down at my body. My left leg looked like a rounded, bat-like object covered in plaster. The foot was gone. I looked around. Maybe it was nearby. Maybe in the next bed. No. When I turned my head, the world spun a bit. When objects were clear again, I saw, on either side of me, beds with side rails holding sleeping kids wearing casts that were slightly different from mine. When I tried to sit up, I realized I could not bend at the waist. I put my hands on my stomach, plastered there, too. I tried to shift my weight but could not. I could not bring my legs together. I could hardly move. Now I was angry as well as confused. "What's this?" I asked, batting at one of the nurse's arms as she helped lift me onto a rolling stretcher. "That's your cast, honey. You're going to get all better now." I knew she was lying. I was trapped again inside those walls of thick plaster. As the nurses wheeled me from recovery back to my room and my waiting parents, I kept screaming, "Let me out of this brick house."
And that's Emily Rapp reading from her new memoir, Poster Child. Emily, did you know before that surgery that your foot was going to be amputated?
My parents had talked to me somewhat about the fact that I was going to have an operation and it was going to change my body, but they spoke of it more in terms of what I was going to get, and that was going to be a prosthesis. And up until that time, I had been wearing a metal brace with a kind of foot bolster on the end to make up for the shortened leg, and it wasn't that functional, and so it was sort of pitched to me as an exciting thing, like, now you're going to get a leg and you're going to be able to move and run and all these great things. So they tried to be really positive about it. And they were also, I also was given a doll that had one leg. And I totally didn't understand what that doll was about, but the people tried to sort of use visual aids with me to help me understand what was about to happen.
What was the problem that you were born with that required these surgeries and the amputation?
I was born with a congenital defect called proximal focal femoral deficiency, which is a long way of saying that one leg was shorter than the other. And so at that time, the way to remedy that situation was to amputate the foot and make a weight-bearing stump so that I could wear a prosthesis and therefore have sort of an artificial symmetry in my body.
And the size of the prosthesis, the length of the prosthesis could change as you grew.
Exactly, exactly.
What are some of the other surgeries you had to have as a child?
I had the amputation, and then I had a fusion of my knee, of the original knee, so that it wouldn't sort of break when I was walking, because I kept falling over. And my doctor referred to this knee as my football knee. I just, you know, it would sort of bend inside the prosthesis. And if you can imagine, that creates a really unstable sort of basis to walk on. So they fused it so that I would have like a stiff lever to move the prosthesis with. And I had several hip surgeries and then the osteotomy, which I mentioned, which was a controlled fracture. It's a way of sort of controlling the deformity. And a lot of these operations I had twice, which is why I ended up having so many, because they either didn't take the first time or, you know, I fell off a bench at school and broke something else. So it was more than it needed to be, in essence.
God, it sounds like torture.
Actually, you know, being in the hospital as a child, especially very sort of attention-seeking, vain little girl, was sort of fun. I mean, people paid a lot of attention to you, and you got presents, and your brother couldn't tease you, and you got to eat whatever you wanted. So it sounds a little bit silly, but I actually enjoyed being in the hospital a lot of times.
Now, in 1980, you became a poster child for the March of Dimes.
Yes.
For the Medicine Bow chapter of Albany County, Wyoming.
Wyoming.
Would you describe, I mean, you were literally on a poster. Would you describe the poster, what your picture was like, what the caption said?
The poster is very 1980, so it's not a gorgeous-looking poster. And it just says on the top, prevent birth defects, and then it says March of Dimes, 1981 Mother's March. And then there's a picture of me with like a few missing teeth in the front, wearing pigtails and a velour blue sort of jumpsuit. And that's it. And then it just has my name and the chapter name.
So how was the poster used and where did you run into it?
Well, it was actually all over the walls of my school. So I ran into it every time I was, you know, going to the bathroom or walk into choir or walk into gym class. And it was in community buildings, in stores, in the church. It was everywhere in this, you know, small town where I lived. So I ran into it quite a bit.
How did it affect you and your body image to have all these pictures of you whose job was to call attention to what set you apart physically from other people?
Mm. At the time, I know I didn't care. At the time, I was just excited to have attention. I think most kids that, I mean, I know some other poster children and we talk about this. It's like you feel so special. You feel so singled out and you don't really care what it's for because at that point it doesn't really matter that your body is different. I mean, you're a child and your body is what it is. And interestingly enough, I never felt disabled as a child, actually, which seems completely silly when you read the book and read about all of these surgeries. But I was just, the leg was just something I had to sort of put on in order to catapult myself into the world, like the hyperactive kid that I was. I do think that being the poster child turned me into a kind of a brat. And in fact, my mom sometimes refers to this book as poster brat instead of poster child, because she said that after that, I was sort of even more of a precocious nightmare than before. So,
you know, some of the posters for people with, you know, birth defects or, mm-hmm. you know, other health problems. Some of those posters, the purpose of them seems to be so that people who don't have the problem depicted in the poster can look mm-hmm. at it and say, there, but for the grace of God,
yeah.
go I. And you feel so grateful that that's not you or that's not like your child. And you're so relieved that you don't yeah. have this like defect that you give money as in a way mm-hmm. almost to like ward off. You know yeah. what I mean? To like you're grateful you don't have it and you're almost like superstitious. So you, did you feel that when you saw yourself on the post? Did you ever feel like people were going to look at you and say, oh, thank God that's not my daughter?
You know? No. Now, of course, I absolutely realize that. And you know, it's interesting that you use that phrase, there, but for the grace of God, go I, because, you know, that's used with all kinds of people in this culture. When people see someone who's homeless or they find out that somebody lost a loved one, they say, oh, that just puts it into perspective. And, you know, it's not very comfortable to be on the other end of that and be sort of the reflection of somebody's worst nightmare, you know?
Right.
I mean, to be someone's mirror, it's really uncomfortable. And so, of course, later looking back at that, I'm like, oh, you know, and I've talked to other poster children and we're just like, what were our parents thinking? But they were probably thinking that maybe it would help us accept our disabilities in a different way. I mean, my parents had no real way or framework that they had never even thought they would have a child with this kind of problem. And it took them so much by surprise. So I don't fault them for making me the poster child by any means.
My guest is Emily Rapp. Her new memoir is called Poster Child. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest Emily Rapp has written a new memoir called Poster Child. She was a March of Dimes poster child when she was six. She had a congenital bone disorder that required her foot, then her leg, to be amputated. Now, in your memoir, Poster Child, you write a little bit about the difficulties of going through puberty, a period when appearance becomes really important.
Mm-hmm.
So did your artificial leg, your prosthetic leg, present new problems to you when you started to go through puberty and then when you started to date?
It did create problems. I think I just realized suddenly that it was no longer this fun toy. It was no longer a way of garnering special attention. It was like a liability in the world of dating and being attractive. And that's when I began to feel really isolated. I felt isolated because I didn't know any other people that were with disabilities that were girls and that were my age. I only knew Vietnam veterans. Those were the guys with artificial legs that I knew. Those were my people. And so they didn't really have much to offer me about going through puberty as a girl in the 1980s. So I was isolated, and I started to become really angry because I didn't know how to deal with it.
Oh, and it sounds like you became really obsessive about your hair and about makeup.
Oh,
and you became anorexic for a while too.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, this is a sort of not common, but unfortunately more common than we think. If you can't sort of meet an impossible standard in society in one way, then maybe you can meet it in another. And so for me, it was, well, if I can't have two legs, well, I'm going to be the skinniest person in my class, which at the time meant the most attractive. I mean, we all know the obsession with thinness is, you know, raging out of control in this country. And at that time, certainly it was being skinny was in. So I thought, well, that's what I'll do. I'll be the skinniest person, and no one will be able to be as skinny as me. And maybe that will somehow, you know, bring up my rank in the attractive category, and sort of overcompensate for this missing leg. It's terrible logic, but when you're going through it, it feels like it makes perfect sense.
And were you rewarded in some way for being that thin?
Yes, I was. In terms of attention, I mean, I've never, ever gotten so many compliments about my appearance as I did when I weighed about 95 pounds in high school. Because that was, you know, it was good to be thin. And that's sort of shocking to me. When I look at those pictures, I think, oh, I look like I need to eat like an enormous sandwich. But at the time, people were like, oh, you know, you look so great. You have such great cheekbone structure. And, you know, and of course, I ate those compliments up. And, you know, but it wasn't something I could maintain. I mean, it would be impossible to maintain any kind of life of the mind on 800 calories a day. So when I got to college, that kind of obsession fell away.
You know, you're right. To remove the leg in front of a man was unthinkable. Mm-hmm. The very thought of it sickened me. I had no sense of myself as a desirable sexual woman, as an amputee.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's really easy to comprehend how you'd feel that way.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what
mm-hmm.
I mean? Because we're,
of
like,
course.
Most people are so self-conscious to begin with.
Of course.
Then you add something like that, and that's even more self-conscious. But was that something you were able to just kind of, like, put behind you? You know, that feeling. Were you able to get past that?
I was, yes. And I think you bring up an important point, because I think one of the great disservices that cultural stereotypes do to people with disabilities, they make us asexual. They sort of rob us of any sexual desire. And you can see this in depictions of people with disabilities in movies, with some exceptions, in literature and in society. And I think, you know, we are sexual people. To say that we're not is to make us somehow subhuman. And so in the process of claiming my sexuality, I had to sort of claim my body. And it, you know, it's of course not something that, you know, every day isn't a great day. It's a process, and sometimes I still struggle with things like that. But yes, I was able to put it behind me, but it wasn't easy.
What is the difference between the prosthetic you have now and what you had when you were a child and first had your foot amputated?
Oh, well, night and day difference. The leg I had up until I was 20, I had the same sort of, I literally had a wooden leg with sort of metal hinges on the side. And if you can imagine the way like a door would swing, the bottom sort of swung freely. It wasn't on any hydraulic system. So the motion was all up to me to run the leg in essence. And it was attached by a waist strap. So you would slip it on over the stump and then tie the strap around and like buckle it in the front. And so it was the sort of the oldest model of a wooden lathe. It's very sort of rudimentary model, but it worked for me. And then I met someone who had an hydraulic prosthesis, and that just totally changed my world. I found a new prosthetist, I got a new leg, and now I have like a 4-bar hydraulic knee that is sort of if you think of a door, the harder you push against a hydraulic door, the more it resists. It's that kind of a system. So like the knee can lock out, I can control my motion more, that kind of thing. And it's also held on by a suction system. So there's no longer a waist strap, which was probably the most uncomfortable thing about wearing the first wooden leg.
So you can get around pretty well now?
Yeah. I mean, I can do what I want to do. I can, you know, be active and do all kinds of different sports. And, you know, if I want to do it, I can usually find a way to do it.
You know, you mentioned that when you were young, the only other people you knew in your town who had limbs that were amputated were veterans.
Right. Well, they weren't even in my town, actually. They were in Denver. So
there was no one in my town. Like a special clinic that you went to.
Uh-huh. Yeah, there was no prosthetic clinic in Laramie. So.
Well, and you say you almost envy them because they all had like a really dramatic story about how they lost the limb. And you didn't. I mean, you lost your foot before you were old enough to really comprehend what was going on. And there wasn't this kind of dramatic war story or anything like that to tell. And I feel like in a way you've substituted your book for that. You know, now you have a whole memoir focusing on it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the thing about the Vietnam vets that was so great is that they gave me my first community of people with disabilities, and they were so non-judgmental. They were so fun to be around. And I don't think, honestly, they quite knew what to do with me because I was so up in their face all the time and, you know, forcing them to play games with me and hopping around. And, you know, and I think they found it a relief to sort of to be with someone who was more playful about having a disability, where for them it was attached to these sort of incredibly traumatic memories. But of course, it's such a 6-year-old's logic to be like, ooh, I wish I had a dramatic story, you know, not having any idea what the implications of that might be. But I really do. I have such a had such love and respect for those guys. They were so brave in a different way than I had ever experienced before.
Have you gone through a lot of your life feeling that you were at war with your body because your bones were growing unevenly and that required the amputation and that required the leg prosthetic? And I mean, it's like you literally were at war at war with your body, like doctors had to like cut off parts of your body over a series of operations. And once you start feeling that way, how do you stop? How do you make peace with your body?
Well, I don't know if I know a clear answer to that. I think the easy answer is to say that you do it every day. You have to say, you know, you have to sort of reclaim that body every day and sort of be forgiving of it. And I don't think I felt as a child at war with my body, again, because I was a child and I sort of just dealt with what was given to me. It was only later in my life that I felt the effects of that and began to feel like, you know, why me, why this, that sort of, you know, those feelings of pity, which I certainly don't have anymore. But I do think that it's, there's no easy answer to that question about making peace. And people often ask me, what was the moment when you finally accepted your body? And my answer to that is, you know, I have to do it all the time. Well, there was no switch that was flipped. And also being conscious of the fact that my whole, you know, worries and self-consciousness about my body is a reflection of my privilege as well. I mean, many people in other places aren't able to you know, sit around thinking about how they feel about their bodies. And I'm also conscious of that, especially people with disabilities around the world. So I guess I would say it's a daily process.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Emily Rapp's new memoir is called Poster Child,